Hi everyone, my name is John and I am an alcoholic. And it's a pleasure to be here tonight. My home group is the Big Book Study Group of South Orange, New Jersey. And as that implies, we're a literature-based meeting. We study the Big Book. We also have this really great 15-week step study that we do. It includes a live four-step workshop. And I think that's how I actually met Rich. I was at a group in central New Jersey doing a four-step workshop where we actually do a four-step right on the blackboard over 3 weeks, and we all take part in it and go through the resentments and go through the fears and the harms. Just out of curiosity, how many people here have done a written four-step? All right, good. It's essential. You know, the steps 1 through 9 are really the basis for the program of action for recovery from alcoholism. So if you haven't done a four-step yet and you've been around for a little while, it's time to get busy with that. You know, these promises that we read in the 9th step do come true. But, you know, it's halfway through the amends process that we usually start to see that. And obviously you don't get to that point until you do steps 1 through 8. When you read the set-aside prayer, I said, I'm home, I feel great. You know, that's what we do in my home group. We read the set-aside prayer at the start of every meeting. And it's so important, you know, dear God, please set aside everything I think I know. And, you know, I think I know a lot of stuff. And, I think it was sometime in my late 40s I realized I was wrong about everything in life. And that's a marvelous place to get to when we finally get to it. I am active in my home group, and besides that, I am also one of the 2 archivists for Alcoholics Anonymous in Northern New Jersey. And I get to take advantage of that, so when I come out and speak, more often than not, I'm giving an AA history talk. So when it comes time to tell my story, which I'll give you some of today, I get to sprinkle in some AA history, which helps stretches it out a little. I'm not a big fan of my own personal story. If you've ever read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, Dr. Bob had said, our stories don't amount to a whole lot. But I do realize it's very, very important to get that identification, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. It is so important, and I know there is probably a newcomer or two here tonight. So I will give you some of my story, as well as sprinkling in the 4 founding moments in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was down in Harrisburg on Saturday doing a workshop down there with a bunch of other historians, and I got to talk about, you know, the 4 founding moments and what is the common message in the 4 founding moments. You know, on page 89 of the book, it says, and this is our 12th suggestion, carry this message. And sometimes this message gets lost in AA now. You know, there's a lot of messages being carried in the rooms, but what is this message? What did the founders mean? You know, back in 1939 when they wrote that, what was this message? Well, anyway, I certainly qualify for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got 100% on the 2-question test on page 44. Right. And page 44 in the Big Book, it says, you know, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. And I love that test because you don't really have to ask a whole lot more of a potential alcoholic. And, you know, in the old days they qualified alcoholics. When you sat down with a newcomer, the first thing you did was qualify him. Let's find out if you're an alcoholic. Because if you're not an alcoholic, maybe this is not the program of recovery for you. I think they figured out later on. Certainly the 12 steps and the program of action works with almost any type of problem you could have. Do you know that there are probably more than 200 organizations that have adopted the 12 steps in one form or another? as a program of recovery for whatever it is, whether it's overeating, whether it's drug use, whether it's gambling. And what is the reason for that is because it's a spiritual program. It's universal. And it really does work if, right, you work it. But I qualified for this fellowship, no problem. As I said, I scored 100%. You know, it's kind of interesting. If you look at those two facts, okay, if when you want to, you cannot quit entirely, what does that mean? I can't stop and stay stopped. How many people here have stopped for a period of time in their recovery only to start again? Certainly me. And I'm going to tell you, that piece so much less qualifies you as the next piece. Can you control your drinking once you start? At one point, I had stopped in recovery for 9 years. And I had what they call on page 33, this lurking notion. I'll get into it, as I tell you my story. But I had this lurking notion. So after 9 years, I picked up a drink to see what it would be like. Well, you could imagine, if you're really an alcoholic, what's going to happen? They have that story in the big book, more about alcoholism. And the very first story is, well, a man of 30 had been doing a great deal of spree drinking, right? He stops drinking for 25 years. Figures after 25 years, okay, I can take a drink. And what happens? He starts to drink. He's dead in 4 years. And that was what my life was looking like after I picked up a drink after 9 years. And I picked up a drink because I wasn't sure I was an alcoholic. Well, I found out pretty quickly. But, you know, this thing about controlling the amount of alcohol once you start drinking, this is the real crux of the physical manifestation of alcoholism. So there's a woman by the name of Marty Mann. In fact, Marty Mann was one of the first women in AA to achieve long-term sobriety. She eventually founded what became the National Council on Alcoholism. But Marty Mann came up with this great test, and I'm going to share it with you because you may have an opportunity at some point to share it with another person or use the test on another person or maybe even use the test on yourself if you're not sure if you're an alcoholic. So Marty says the test has to last at least 6 months, but no longer than a year. And the test is this, and it doesn't matter how often you drink, but if you're going to drink, you must have at least one and no more than three. So, and you could be a once a week drinker, once a month drinker, it doesn't matter, but the test is if you drink, you must have at least one, wet the whistle a little, but no more than three. And it doesn't matter what's going on or what the circumstances are surrounding this. Somebody could be get married. Somebody could be getting married. I could have hit the lottery. Somebody could have just died. My son graduated high school. My daughter is going to the pro. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter the circumstance. You have to have at least one and no more than three. And the minute you have exceeded the limit, the test is over. You either win or you fail, whichever you consider it. And that's it. You are an alcoholic. Now, can you see the value of that test? Can anyone here successfully drink under control? If you can, you're probably in the wrong place. You should be out there drinking under control and enjoying your drinking. Well, that's what they tell you in the big book, actually. If you're not sure, go out and try some controlled drinking. So it's so much less as to whether or not you could stop and stay stopped for a period of time. Because most alcoholics will be able to do that. But I'm going to tell you, if you're a real alcoholic and you stop for a period of time and then start, in a very little time, you'll be as bad as ever. And, you know, so I started off with normal drinking. You know, well, normal drinking, I think of it now. I had my first drink when I was 11. I don't know if you call that normal drinking. And I was born in the late 50s, so I'm a product of that time. you know, coming of age in the late 60s and the early 70s. So besides alcohol, there were some other substances that were going around, non-conference approved type stuff. And I got involved in all of it. You know, by the time I was 14 and 15, I had pretty much tried everything there was. And if I look at it, you know, what was this doing for me? And I could see it clearly now. You know, it was taking me outside of myself. You know, it's a form of transcendence, okay? Not necessarily, I didn't think at the time, oh, I need to escape from life. I mean, that wasn't there. But there was something about this alteration that would take place whenever it was that I was, you know, using some mind-altering thing. And, it, you know, it began with alcohol. And, you know, the idea that alcohol is, and is certainly a gateway, you know, substance, I wouldn't disagree with it at all. So by the time I was 20, I was helpless and hopeless. And by the time I was 28, I went into my first rehab place upstate New York called Arms Acres. I don't know if there's any alumni. I sometimes run into an alumni. And it was there that I learned all about addiction and, you know, all the good stuff. It was there I got my first taste of AA. But what they had really told me up there was that I had a different problem, a problem other than alcohol. And but they said very, very clearly, in order to deal with that problem, you're going to have to abstain from alcohol. They told me I was cross-addicted. I remember saying that in a meeting one time, and an old-timer said, we're addicted to crosses? No. And for the longest time, if you pushed back on me, when I told my story and I talked about other substances in AA, I would get pissed. You know, today I've learned, I kind of take the temperature and go with where I'm at. In Alcoholics Anonymous, if a group says, you know, we focus on alcohol, that's what I do. Okay, it's very, very easy to tell my story and take out any other part. If I'm in a group that talks about things other than alcohol, I could do that too. Out of respect for AA, I try to really talk about alcohol. But anyway, in the rehab, they told me, well, you know, your problem is this, but you need to stay away from alcohol. So I did. And when it came time to deciding which of the two fellowships I should join, I somehow felt more comfortable in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found my first sponsor in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I kind of began to feel like I fit in. So that worked out fine. And my first go-around, and I first got sober in 1989. And my first go-around, I ended up getting sober in 88, lasted about 60 days and picked up again. And it was about another year before I ended up back in the rehab again. Back then, I was a union member and I could just go to the EAP and say, look, I need help, and they ship you off to the 30-day program, which is great. In fact, I had two $11,000 big books. It was a wonderful thing. My second time in the rehab, and I went right back to the same place, I had a powerful spiritual experience in that rehab. I won't get into all the details. It wasn't quite the white light experience that Bill Wilson had. But I'll tell you, I had a voice in my head that was telling me things that I had never heard before. And it propelled me, it rocketed me into this new way of living. But you know what happened? So in just the twinkling of an eye, I came to believe. And it was a very, very powerful thing, and it kept me sober for many, many years. But the problem is I jumped right over step one in that. All right? And I never came to understand this stuff that I just talked about. I had this lurking notion, right? That's the crux of step one. It says on page 33, if you're planning to quit drinking, there can be no lurking notion or reservation of any kind that one day you will be immune to alcohol. And because I considered myself to be someone other than an alcoholic, It was in my mind, and I can remember thinking this, well, I'll go 10 years. I'll go 10 years. Now, the type of problem I had was a real bad problem. It was one of those problems that bring you to your knees a hell of a lot quicker than maybe alcohol. Sometimes alcohol can be a long, drawn-out process. You know, I love it in the 12 and 12 where they talk about under the lash of alcoholism, we are driven to AA. Then and only then to become we become as willing to listen and open to conviction as only the dying can be. That's a great place to be, believe it or not, for someone who's suffering from addiction. You know, willing to listen and open to conviction. And if you look up conviction in the dictionary and what that means, it means willing to be convinced. Willing to be convinced of what? And we'll get to that in a minute. But that's the jumping off place. And for so many of us, that's a very, very painful process. If you're here and you consider yourself low bottom, and I was a low bottom, you know, I'll tell you about that. But we're out in the lake, right? Picture yourself, you're in the middle of the lake and you're drowning, right? You're going down for the first time. Going down for the second time. Along comes a rowboat, and we throw you this life preserver that says spirituality on it, right? And you say, the hell with that. You throw it back, right? I don't want that. Well, then drown, dumbass. But, you know, that's what it is. And open to conviction, willing to listen. When you go down for the third time and your next breath is going to draw water into your lungs, your attitude changes really fast, doesn't it? You know, it certainly can. And that's, you know, the low bottom thing I talk about. So I picked up a drink after 9 years of sobriety, actually 2 days short of what would have been my 9th anniversary. I was at a party in a foreign country, and I was away from my wife and children, and so there's that lurking notion. Actually, I'd gone to this party with the intention of, like, drinking a non-alcoholic beer, and they ran out of non-alcoholic beer, so someone handed me a nip bottle of Budweiser, right? You know, those 7-ounce bottles, and I only drank half of it. And there's a line in the Big Book that talks about, you know, I realized, I thought I was not being too smart about this, but, you know, I did it anyway. So there was, I drank half this nip bottle of Budweiser, and I knew I was not being too smart. And, okay, it passed. A week or two went by, and I went out to dinner with some friends, and I had 3 beers at dinner. You know, people were shocked. You know, John's drinking. They had never seen me drink. It's okay, I'm not an alcoholic. It's, you know, my problem was this, right? It wasn't alcohol. So a couple of weeks later, I'm going through the airport, and again, I'm in a foreign country where they don't sell alcohol, and my mind says, I better get a couple of bottles in the duty-free. So I picked up 3 bottles of alcohol. And that weekend, I proceeded to drink myself poison. You know, just uncorked it and started drinking. And so if there was ever a doubt that I was an alcoholic, it was kind of dispelled that weekend. So, you know, they talk about in the Big Book the manifestation, this physical manifestation. And they call it the phenomenon of craving, right? So if you're a real alcoholic, this is what it looks like. Once you put any alcohol into your body whatsoever, it triggers this reaction that is it, and it's an abnormal reaction. It's different from what most people get. And what happens is as soon as I have that first drink, my mind starts to think about the second drink. And I put the second drink in, and the effect is multiplicative in that it begins to increase this craving. So the second drink demands a third drink, and the third drink demands a fourth drink. And if you're a real alcoholic, and it may not happen on the first occasion, it may not happen that weekend that you happen to crack open a bottle after 9 years of abstinence, But sooner or later, it's going to happen. If you're a real alcoholic and you've stopped for a period of time, you will start up again. And I used the analogy of the man of 30 who was doing a great deal of spree drinking. What happened after that, within a month, I was in a hospital in this foreign country, and I had to go for detox. I could not stop drinking. I got to the point where if I went through a night of drinking and I woke up in the morning with a bad hangover, I started drinking in the morning. Because, I would feel so sick from the night before, the only thing that would cure it was a little hair of the dog that bit me. But then once I had that first drink and again triggered the allergy, I couldn't stop. I went like that, on and off drinking for 7 years before I came back in. And what happened was I had to lose everything. Because I eventually went back to that other substance. And now, having been sober for 9 years, having been successful, I now had the means with which to destroy myself, which was money. I had enough money that I could fuel the partying the way that I liked. And within 2 years, I'm going to tell you, I went through more money than you could imagine. And I love it again in the 12 and 12, right, in step two. It said, and when our scorecards finally read zero, and one more strike was going to put us out of the game forever, it was then that we came to AA, and it was there that we discovered or rediscovered our lost faith. And when I came back in 2006, that's what I looked like. I had almost nothing left. And it was then that I really began to learn things that I had never learned. And one of the promises is we will not regret the past nor wish to close the door on it. And I do not regret the past one bit. Every single thing that occurred in my life went into making my life what it is today and the recovery that I have today. But there was a lot of things that I needed to learn. And the very first thing I did in the rehab was I read the big book for the first time. My whole time in sobriety, and I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in Brooklyn, New York. That's where I had lived at the time. And I went to meetings for about 5 out of the 9 years. But I went from being an alcoholic to a workaholic. And I'm going to tell you, I probably never even really understood what it meant to be an alcoholic. I never read that piece on page 44 that says this and this. And by the way, the next thing it says, and it says, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience can conquer. And I had had this wonderful spiritual experience that propelled me into recovery. But the problem was I never did anything to further it. Yeah, I had done a fourth step. I had found a sponsor. I wouldn't call him a big book sponsor. And he had kind of taken me through the steps. And I will tell you, I did a very thorough and honest fourth step and fifth step. And I had done the amends of the ninth step. But that continuance piece was missing. Steps 10, 11, and 12. I could look back now and see all the time I was in the AA, nobody ever asked me to sponsor them. I wonder why. Because, what did I have to give? I had time. I had sobriety. But I'm sure, as I remember, all my sharing was selfish type sharing. Maybe it was all that psychological treatment center type stuff. But I read the big book for the first time when I went through rehab again. So now he's in Fair Oaks or Summit Oaks down in New Jersey. And I committed to reading the big book. And I might as well have been reading a book in another language. It was like Swahili to me. Forget it. I didn't understand it. About 9 months in, someone introduced me to the Joe and Charlie tapes. And I listened to these two guys that were taped in 1988 in Laughlin, Nevada, do this thing called The Big Book Comes Alive. And I'm going to tell you, The Big Book came alive for me. And I listen to these tapes over and over and over again. We actually listen to them in a group setting on a Sunday night. And I'm going to tell you, if you would ask me today who were my sponsors, I would tell you Joe and Charlie. Because they did more to help enhance my sobriety than anybody ever did. And it was an amazing thing. And I had a good sponsor, and I had been procrastinating. I was kind of like, well, what step, y'all? Well, I'm just doing 1, 2, and 3. I'm just working 1, 2, and 3. What about that 4th step? No, I'm just, 1, 2, and 3. And I think God took pity on me because he sent someone my way about 1.5 years into sobriety. He sent somebody my way who asked me, would you sponsor me? And rather than answer him, I guess I instinctively knew, let me ask my sponsor. What a novel idea before I commit to something. Let me ask my sponsor. And I went and asked Jack, and Jack said, go ahead. You can sponsor them, but you need to get your own work done. And I guess it was that paternal instinct that kicked in, the desire to want to help somebody else, that got me busy. And in no time at all, I had done my 4th step, I had done my 5th step, I had done the very quick work of 6, 7, and 8, had begun to make amends. And with the beginning of my amends, you move right into 10, 11, and 12. You know, you don't have to wait once you start your 9-step amends. It says in step 10, we commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. And I'm going to tell you, from the time you sit and write your 4th step, you could be on your 10th and 11th steps just a day or two later. You know, if you can get your amends going right after that, that's all it takes. And I think that was the business of Alcoholics Anonymous. They meant to get you busy quickly. Not like, well, oh, I'm going to live in steps 1, 2, and 3 for a while. No, that was never the intent. The intent was to move this thing along. If your goal is to hike the mountains in Northern California, what do you need to do first? You need to get your butt over to California. Right? And then you can get into the mountains, and then you can fulfill your purpose. And, well, the joy is in the journey. Not really. The joy is getting to where you want to be and then living, you know, in there. And that's like living in the solution. This past weekend, I was down in Harrisburg, and we talked about the 4 founding moments in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Remember, I said before, what is this message? You know, page 89 of the big book. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message. And carrying this message is critical to my sobriety. And I might suggest it's probably very important to yours as well. I get the sense that that's what this group is all about. Carrying this message. So what is this message? Like I said, there's lots of messages being carried in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all I know is if I want to be a good AA member, I want to carry this message. I want to carry AA's message. So what is that message? And we find it in these 4 founding moments. So there was a great historian by the name of Ernest Kurtz. And he wrote a book called Not God. Some of you might know this book. But it's the premier AA history book still to this day. And Ernie died a couple of years ago, but his work carries on. And he said, in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, there were 4 key moments. 4 key moments. As a historian, I like to talk about synchronicity. And I'm not talking about the album by the Police. Synchronicity is this concept that came from this famous psychiatrist named Carl Jung, who is also very much tied up in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the gist of synchronicity is this, that at different times and places, seemingly unrelated events are taking place that have, in fact, a common purpose. And the history of Alcoholics Anonymous is the most marvelous example of synchronicity. And the other thing about synchronicity, so these things are taking place at different times that have a common purpose, but there is some guiding hand or force bringing it about. In the idea of synchronicity, there is no coincidences. And the four founding moments in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous is one, when Roland Hazard went to see Carl Jung in Switzerland. Two, when Ebbie Thatcher came and had a talk sitting at the kitchen table in Bill's kitchen. Three, when Bill Wilson went into the town's hospital and had this dramatic white light experience. And four, when Bill Wilson went to Akron, Ohio and met Dr. Baum. And these four moments proved to be synchronicity, because they were all so tied together that you could never imagine. And I'm going to tell you the whole history of the recovery process in the United States and in the world grew out of these four founding moments. So I'm not going to get into all four moments, but I'll touch on two of them right now. And the first moment, and we'll leave these up when the meeting's over. If you want to come and take a quick look at them, that would be great. But the first founding moment, and I've come to call this now a parable in AA history, was this story in the big book, and I think it's on page 26. It's the story of this certain American businessman. I'll read it quick, in case you've never heard it. So a certain American businessman had ability, good sense, and high character. For years he had floundered from one sanitarium to another. He had consulted the best-known American psychiatrists. Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of a celebrated physician, the psychiatrist Dr. Jung, who prescribed for him. Though experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. His physical and mental condition were unusually good. Above all, he had believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable. Nonetheless, he was drunk in a short time. More baffling still, he could give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. So this is the story of a New England industrialist whose name was Roland Hazard. Roland came from Rhode Island. His family was a very wealthy family that had a great place in American history. It's rumored that one of the Hazards had come over on the Mayflower. Their family was active in the Civil War, what you would call today blue blood, right? So Roland was born into all this money. And Roland's family was an industrialist-type family, and they owned a number of businesses. In fact, and Roland was being groomed to be a director in these businesses. He was a Yale graduate. He had been a state senator from Rhode Island for the period of 1914 to 1916. And he was a director in what was then known as the Peacedale Manufacturing Companies. These companies later came together to form the Allied Chemical Dyeing Chemical Company. And later that became the Fortune 500 company, Allied Signal. Roland's future was assured, but Roland had one problem. He was one of us. When he had the first drink, there was no controlling how much he would take. So the story has, they have him visiting all the best-known doctors in America, clergy, because what did they do with alcoholics back then? They sent you to the drying out place, to the loony bin, really, for the most part. Sanitarium is another name for, you know, a hospital where they put you where they don't want to know about you anymore. So they send Roland to Carl Jung, and Carl Jung spends a long period of time psychoanalyzing Roland. Says, well, we uncovered all the hidden springs, that relapse was unthinkable. So Roland leaves Carl Jung. There's a funny story that goes, well, he got as far as Paris coming back to America, and someone asked him the wrong question. Roland, would you like a drink? Yes, I'll have a drink. So a period of time elapses, and then Roland goes back to Carl Jung. And he says, What's the deal? In the big book, it says, above all, he wanted to regain self-control. You see Roland's problem? He wants to learn how to control and enjoy his drinking. It says it again. It's the great obsession of every alcoholic that somehow, someday, he will learn to control and enjoy his drinking. By the way, that's behind all of our repeated attempts. It talks about it in the big book. Why do we recreate that disaster of the first drink? Because it's our great obsession that somehow we will learn to control and enjoy our drinking, right? The pickle wants to go back to being a cucumber, and it's just not going to happen. There is something beyond that that drives us. And I'm going to kind of hopefully get to that as we close. There really is something beyond that allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. And that's the message of these four founding moments. But Jung tells Roland, well, for a while I thought I was going to be successful with you, but now I can see that you are an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And you have little chance unless you hire a bodyguard to lock yourself up. You are either going to die or go permanently insane. And Roland looks at him and says, but, you know, are there no exceptions? And Jung says, yeah, Roland, there are exceptions. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics of your type have had these great spiritual experiences. And he says, they're phenomenon to me. I don't understand them, but they have been known to work. And the only thing I could suggest to you is that you place yourself in the atmosphere, the religious atmosphere of your choosing, and hope that the lightning strikes, because that's your only hope. And Roland eventually found the needed spiritual experience when he joined this first century Christianity fellowship, this first century fellowship called the Oxford Group. And it was there in the Oxford Group that Roland learned the value of service. The Oxford Group had this neat little program where you share, where you make restitution for the harms that you've done. Okay? You take an inventory. And where you seek God's guidance. And Roland found this spiritual experience within the Oxford Group. And that led to the second founding moment. The second founding moment was when Ebby Thatcher carried the message to Bill Wilson at 182 Clinton Street. So Ebby Thatcher was Bill's boyhood school friend. And they had gone to school together in Vermont. And Ebby, like Roland, came from a very, very wealthy blue blood family. They came out of Albany, New York, and they summered up in Vermont, and Ebby went to school in Vermont, and that's how he met Bill. But Ebby and Ebby's family was involved in politics in Albany. His brother had been the mayor of Albany, and his uncle had been the mayor of Albany. And Ebby was like Bill, a terrible alcoholic. And Ebby was having such trouble with alcohol, the family sent him off to Vermont in the summer of 1934. And Ebby got into trouble with the law. First, he had a drunk driving incident where he drove his car into somebody's farmhouse, like crashed up into the house and into the kitchen, gets out of the car, and the lady of the house is there freaking out, and he says, "Could I have a cup of coffee?" He had another incident where he's painting the house, and some pigeons are coming by and they're wrecking the new paint job, and Ebby comes out with a shotgun and starts blasting away in Manchester, Vermont. And they'll lock you up for doing stuff like that. So Ebby's appearing before the judge in Bennington, Vermont. They're going to commit Ebby to the state insane asylum in Brattleboro. And who's up there at the time but Roland Hazard, the certain American businessman, and another Oxford grouper by the name of Seba Graves. And it was Seba's father, Judge Collins Graves, that was hearing the case on Ebby. Synchronicity. So they go to the judge and say, release Ebby in our custody. We think we can help him. We think we have a program that might work. The judge says, okay, you could have him, just get him the hell out of Vermont. They bring Evie to New York and put him in at the Calvary Mission. They hook him up with Sam Shoemaker, and Evie sobers up. One of the Oxford Group tenets was that in order to keep an experience, and I'll tell you, it was an experience of Christ, that's what they called it, you had to pass it on. We have a book in AA called Pass It On. The title goes back to those days. So Evie's thinking, well, who can I pass it on to? And he knows his friend Bill Wilson, washed up stock analyst, is in trouble. And then you see the story in the big book, Bill's story. So my musing was interrupted one day. So here's Bill, who's gone through three detoxes already in the town's hospital, totally washed up. He's lost everything, as bad as I lost everything. He's got nothing left. His wife's working to support him. Evie calls and says, can I come over and see you? And Bill says, oh, this is great. We're going to relive old times. We're going to sit at the kitchen table. We're going to drink together. And Evie shows up in a suit, fresh skinned and glowing. Bill pushes a drink across the table to him, and Evie says, no, Bill, I'm not drinking. And Evie says, well, Bill says, come now. What's gotten into you? And Evie looks straight at Bill and says, simply, and the big book, I love the way they write this, simply but smilingly, he says, I've got religion. And Bill rolls his eyes. It's the last thing he's expecting to hear. Remember, though, you're in the middle of the lake. You're going down for the third time. Willing to listen and open to conviction. Willing to be convinced. Convinced of what? That you're alcoholic and you could not manage your own life. First thing that you have to be convinced of. You're alcoholic and could not manage your own life. Well, what brand of religion do you have, Ebby? And Ebby says, well, Bill, I guess you could just call it the religion of common sense. And he says it in the big book. He says, but my friend did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men appeared before the judge and convinced them to release me to this little program of action. And he says, that was 2 months ago, and the result is self-evident. It worked. So here's Bill, ready for his fourth detox. He's 40 pounds underweight, says in the book, 40 pounds underweight. Bill Wilson's not a big guy. When you're a man and you're 40 pounds underweight, you're on death's doorstep. Get it? Bill was willing to listen and open to conviction. And he said, we talked for hours and childhood memories passed before me. What is Ebby doing? He's not preaching. He's sharing his experience. And you know what? If you ever hear the expression that you might be the only big book somebody ever reads, you are. I very much respect that you say wear a shirt and wear a coat and tie at the podium. I may be the only big book that somebody ever reads. And I may say something that may just crack the ego of a hardened alcoholic. And this is what Ebby's doing in a matter-of-fact way. He's sitting there and they're talking with Bill. And the prejudices and the agnosticism that Bill has from his childhood is just beginning to crack just a little bit. Because Bill was going down for the third time, and he was becoming willing to listen and open to conviction as only the dying can be. And he had to be. Here's Ebby, who was as bad as Bill just a few months before. And Ebby's there in a shirt and tie and a coat, and he's looking good. And Bill has to listen to it. Bill has to listen to it. And Ebby didn't overstay his welcome. You know, but Ebby says that line to Bill that's recorded in the big book. So they're arguing him back and forth, what God is, what God isn't. And then finally Ebby says to Bill, well, why don't you just choose your own concept of God? And then Bill writes, that statement hit me hard. It melted the icy mountain, intellectual mountain, whose shadow I had stood and shivered for many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. And that's really the beginning of the recovery, when we start to say, I can't, he can, I think I'll let him. We don't have to understand to what we're surrendering to. It doesn't matter. Okay? The only thing we really have to admit when they talk about conceding defeat is, look, my way didn't work. Is there anyone here that claims their method for living was successful? I'm assuming you didn't come here to meet new and exciting people, right? You came here because under the lash of alcoholism, you were driven here. And it talks about in the book, we had but two ways to go. One was to go on drinking until the bitter end, blotting out as best we could. The other was to accept spiritual help. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out physically and mentally. That's the crux of the founding moments. Okay, the ABCs on page 60, right? A, we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. By the way, if you can't manage your own life, you need a new manager. Step three, we get up and we resign as manager. I quit. Right? They should have fired me long ago. I sucked at managing my own life. But if your life's unmanageable, ask yourself, who's managing it? And the answer will always be me. B, no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. The crux of Jung's message to Roland Hazard was, you don't have a medical problem. And if you don't have a medical problem, a medical solution will not apply. That's why the doctors and the psychiatrists really never got anywhere with us. Because the problem was not medical. And what Jung told Hazard in no unmistakable terms was, you have a spiritual problem. You know, alcohol for the longest time in the old days was called spirits. Ask yourself why. Because when I drank alcohol, I got real spiritual, didn't I? I did. When I used a lot of these substances, I got real spiritual, didn't I? I had some wonderful spiritual experiences. And I know you did too. Many, many years later, Bill Wilson traded letters with Carl Jung. And they're in the grapevine. And Jung said, I'm going to tell you the real deal now. And he said, Roland's alcoholism was the equivalent of, on a low level, his search for wholeness. He wanted union with God. The problem with me, and I learned it so many years later, was my alcoholism and drug use was always a search for the spiritual. It was a quest for union with the power greater than myself that had gone horribly wrong. But it came close to looking like something spiritual. And what Jung eventually told Bill was that the operative formula, the solution, is called spiritus contra spiritum. And he said, in Latin, you use the same word, spiritus, to describe God. And you use the same word to define alcohol. So translated into English, it takes the power of God to overcome the power of alcoholism. And that's the spiritual malady. And when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. When I learned that my real problem was a spiritual one, I was able to embrace the spiritual solution. And the thing is, in AA, that can look like anything you want it to be. Just realize that you are no longer in control of you. Surrender. And then get better. Thanks for letting me share.
John, thanks so much for your story, and thanks for all the eye candy, man. My name's Mickey. I'm an alcoholic. So, a little bit over 4 years ago, I came into this program, and God puts people in our lives for certain reasons. And I used to thank this man over and over and over again, and he would say, "Don't thank me, thank God." And the truth of the matter is, he's a beautiful example, a prime example of what AA does in your life. His service is unbelievable, and his love and caring for all of us deadbeat alcoholics is awesome. He's got a great message. He's a wonderful man. Like I said, he's a true example of what happens when you take action in this program. And so this is the one night that I'm allowed to thank him, and he can't yell at me or tell me to thank God. I do have the honor and privilege to give my dear buddy Rich his 12-year coin. So would you please help me? Thank you. Thank God.
My name is Rich. I'm an alcoholic. I don't have the capacity to say a whole lot. I got throat issues, as you can well hear, but I will tell you that I did not get to this point in my recovery by doing one step a year. I love you people. This is about love, man. This is about sacrificing of oneself for the benefit of someone that perhaps you don't even know. And I don't do it perfectly, but I do it. And I think that's why I'm still sober today and relatively happy. I mean, my shit's up against the wall pretty hard and heavy right now. But, you know, the furthest thing from my mind has been taking a drink. And I've kind of upped my efforts to help others, and even outside of AA. So if you're new, thank you, John, so much. If you're new, man, there's no need to suffer any longer. There's just no reason for it. Because you're going to freaking die, basically, if you're one of us for real. And grab a hold of somebody that has got this idea in their head. It's called the Big Book. It's a great idea. Anyway, thank you so much. I love all of you.